the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
What a day for a daydream. What a day for a daydreaming boy. And I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy. And even if time ain't really on my side, it's one of those days for taking a walk outside. I'm blowing the day to take a walk in the sun and follow my face on somebody's new mowed lawn. I've been having a sweet dream. I've been dreaming since I woke up today. It's starring me in my sweet dream, 'cause she's the one makes me feel this way. And even if time is passing me by a lot, I couldn't care less about the dues you say I got. Tomorrow I'll pay the dues for dropping my load, a pie in the face for being a sleepy bulldog. You may pick up your ears, or you may be daydreaming for a thousand years. What a day for a daydream, custom made for a daydreaming boy. I'm lost in a daydream, dreaming about my bundle of joy.
Loving Spoonful once had a hit with What a Day for a Daydreamer. So did David Cassidy. He was also daydreaming. Should we just pay attention, or has daydreaming got something to actually offer us in the 21st century, especially when research has suggested that the average UK office worker is spending 6 hours and 21 minutes a week daydreaming at work? That's pretty much almost a full day. Well, somebody can give us the answer to this and hopefully suggest that maybe daydreaming could actually boost productivity is, of course, our ace TV neuroscientist and indeed tremendous author. It's Dr. Jack Lewis. How are you, Jack?
I'm good, Alex. Nice to see you. How are you?
Likewise. Good to connect with your good self. Now, the day we know the mind operates in all kinds of ways, and we tune in and we tune out and we work through that whole process. This research that's been done by SodaStream, were you surprised by the fact that over 6 hours per day is given, or per week, I should say, to daydreaming, which again translates into, but that's £461 million worth of pay going to workers simply to daydream? Or is it a case of, well, no, we're human beings?
It's an excellent investment for all those businesses. And the only surprise for me was that it was so little. I think 6 hours a week daydreaming on the job is quite a small amount. Because back in the day when research was done a couple of decades ago, it transpired that the baseline was 25 to 50% of our waking day was spent daydreaming. So either we're not daydreaming as much as we used to, or the measurements have got worse, or people are less honest when they're asked how much do you daydream. But the upshot is, it's not actually surprising that people daydream less, because if you think about it, since I think the data I was quoting from the 90s, that's a long time ago now. Since then, screens have become much more ubiquitous in our lives, and it eats into the time that we would otherwise be spending daydreaming just to pass the time, just in order not to be bored. One of my favorite data points from this SodaStream research was that 7 out of 10 people say they have a great idea while or as a direct result from daydreaming. 1 in 3 say they feel less anxious or stressed, which is lovely in and of itself, that these flights of fancy can give us a break from the stresses and anxieties of daily living. And perhaps we solve some of those problems. More than a quarter said they've solved both personal and professional problems through daydreaming. So Why would this be? The upshot is we spend so much time processing the external world, like sights and sounds come in through our eyes and ears. There's a constant barrage in most people's lives, not just from their immediate environment, but from the screens they choose to put in front of their faces, that there's very little time left to contemplate. And the joy of daydreaming is you essentially block out the outside world and you just focus your attention inwards into the thoughts, the recent experiences that have happened, and you can put them into the context of your entire life experience and thereby learn from what's happened recently more effectively.
What is this world so full of care? We have no time to stand and stare, to quote a poet from times past.
Off the top of your head, very impressive.
But just looking at the way in which this is dealing with the 21st century, and we know in a sense, okay, we're not necessarily doing hard manual work. Some of us are, obviously, but a lot of us are office-based or environment. You've got a lot of screen-based material which is within that. There's a constant focus and the demands to be focused on the problem, etc. And what you've just described, Jack, seems, on the surface at least, to be slightly counterintuitive, that actually we get to the stage of saying, well, actually, sometimes you do need to take time out to allow things to develop, to percolate. Is that just because of the way our mind operates?
It's exactly right. It's a perfectly natural part of the way our mind operates, alternating between turning the attention outwards. Attention is basically like blocking out certain things and focusing on a narrow beam of information, you know, cutting out the clutter. But then having done that, you need periods of reflection in order to make sense of it. And it's the critical difference between convergent thinking, where your attention is narrowed down on the information presented on a screen, be it text, be it images, be it moving images. The interpretations of those kind of media are narrow by definition, because a journalist wrote the text, an artist drew the picture, a director, you know, created the narrative, and they want you to, your mind to think of very certain specific thoughts. Whereas divergent thinking, which is essentially what this SodaStream campaign is encouraging, enables you to go off on a flight of fancy that expands your imagination, that improves the depth and breadth of your ability to dream up fantastical or mundane scenarios that help you solve real life problems.
Can you prescribe this in a way that actually works? I mean, I've been struck over the years at many initiatives that have initially had an initial peak, whether it's be, well, let's have everybody sitting around on beanbags, for instance, or let's do this, 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 or this. Or is it a case of everybody has their own unique way of having a daydream, and it's not necessarily zoning out, although it might look as though you're zoning out?
Yeah, if to the outside world, it can look like you're in another world. And maybe you are. And if you are, then good on you. So everyone daydreams differently. And I think that's as much to do with whether or not they were criticized for daydreaming in the past. You know, some people were allowed to do it and it wasn't a big deal. Other people were scolded, let's say at school, for looking out the window and not paying any attention and, you know, being asked a question and their mind was elsewhere. So it's got a bad rap. It's got a bad rep. And the first thing one needs to do if you want to kind of get better at daydream is give yourself permission to do it. Then when you do it, don't restrict yourself to daydreaming about mundane things in the privacy of your own mind. If you want to fly, you can fly. If you want to, you know, dive underwater, hold your breath for an hour, swim with the dolphins, you can do that. But first thing, you have to have the notion to do it and then give yourself permission to do it. So those are the first things. And as with anything in the brain, and I'm sure you'll remember me saying this in previous encounters, but anything that we do regularly, intensively, and keep it up over long periods of time will physically change the structure of our brains. The synapses that enable the various brain areas to communicate to each other will become more numerous, which makes the connections between them more effective, more efficient. And so if we do a little bit every day, let's say, you know, 5 minutes on the hour, every hour, that's quite liberal. You won't always remember to do it, but it's a good starting point. And, you know, switch your phone on silent, take yourself off somewhere quiet. You can plan how you will, you know, where in your day you might have these daydreaming moments, above and beyond those that happen spontaneously. And you can plan, let's say, where you might start the journey. You might imagine yourself going on a walk through the mountains or through the woods or along the tide line of a beach. And then, but where you go from there, well, that's up to your internal brain. The whole point of divergent thinking is it's not prescribed. Everyone will have different notions and emotions and thoughts and memories popping around in their brain. And it depends what's bubbling up. Very nice. It depends what's bubbling up from your unconscious. And the thing that's of critical importance here is it's not a waste of time to daydream, because if you're daydreaming and you're turning your attention not without but within, it gives you the opportunity to catch some of these ideas, solutions to problems that are constantly bubbling up from our unconscious brain, like the parts that we're not aware of, breaking the surface into our conscious awareness. But if our conscious awareness is so busy dealing with external stimuli, you're not going to notice them. So the key point is, by switching off from the outside world and looking within, you can catch some of these unconscious brain processes, which very subtly translate into stuff you can become aware of. And I like to think of it, well, when I talk about creative napping, I always think of it as when you come up from your nap, you want to have your butterfly net ready, because they these great ideas, they'll flit off in a moment. You need to be ready to catch them.
And that's to do with productivity. How does this gel with meditation and the notion that an awful lot of people would say that time to actually engage in mindfulness, to actually take a few moments to work on that? Is that also something which crosses over with this? Or is it a case of, you can't be mindful and creative? That's an oxymoron.
No, it's an excellent question. And when you look at neuroscience studies where you stick people in scanners and you ask them to meditate, and then you look at those studies where they put people in scanners and ask them to daydream. In fact, you don't need to ask them to daydream. It used to happen in my own studies. But at the time, when I was looking at how do brains process audio and visual information, and in particular, audio-visual information, where it's presented through the eyes and the ears at the same time, I'd give them rests. And during the rests, instead of the outer parts of the brain that process sensory information lighting up, those would quieten down. And these ones along the midline, the anterior cingulate, the posterior cingulate, they'd light up like a Christmas tree. And for me at the time, it was irritating, because I was expecting it was supposed to be my baseline, the rest level. But anyway, the upshot is it's always been there in these studies. It just took us a while to figure out what it all meant. But the answer is it's very, very similar. The default mode network, these brain areas where, if you like, the you in you, the me in me actually resides and contemplates what's going on and puts together life experiences into everything. It's very, very same. It's very, very similar. Like the default mode network, it does nighttime dreaming, although we don't have much control over that. It does daytime dreaming, daydreaming, where we have some control over it. And then in meditation, typically we have much greater control, because we're usually following some kind of focus, repeatedly drawing our attention to something that's ever present and always in the present moment, like breathing, you know. So it's very, very similar. But one thing, whether you're meditating or whether you're daydreaming or night dreaming, the one thing to sort of remember that's the overarching message here is you've got to stay hydrated, because all of those processes function much better if you're adequately hydrated. And the reason is those 86 billion brain wires, neurons in our brain, sending electrical messages in a hydrated brain at 250 miles per hour. If you're even slightly dehydrated, it slows down the transmission of those electrical messages. And so it means all of those messages, there are trillions of these action potentials being sent every second, and they're all getting to their destination a little bit too late, which leads to inefficiencies, lapses of memory, inability to focus, all this kind of stuff. And it's most important for people to bear this in mind the older they get, because our sense of thirst kicks in quite quickly when we become slightly dehydrated when we're young, adolescents and so forth. But in an older brain, our sense of thirst takes longer and longer to kick in. So you have to be more and more preemptive in sipping water, because by the time like a middle-aged person like me becomes thirsty, I've been dehydrated for quite a long time. And so therefore my brain processes, whether it's, you know, daydreaming or planning or problem solving, they're all slightly, functioning at a lower level than they could be if I remember to preemptively sip delicious fizzy water throughout the day.
There you go. I mean, SodaStream came up with the research. Where can people actually find out further details about the things we've been talking about today, Jack?
Right, so if they go to sodastream.co.uk, there are some Daydreamer artworks that we've commissioned by this amazing graphic artist, which are somewhat reminiscent of the magic eye art of the 90s, which will mean something to some people and nothing to others. But the idea is that it will foster creative flights of fancy in order to sort of benefit. The tagline is, if you can dream it, you can stream it. And there's a whole load of stuff at sodastream.co.uk people can use to expand their horizons.
I also like the phrase, thoughts become things, so choose the good ones. That's another line we can actually talk about. But we
love it. Choose the good ones. Steer yourself away from rumination, negative thinking, towards the good stuff. Couldn't agree with you more.
Dr. Jack Lewis, a neuropsychologist extraordinaire, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on until next time.
Always a pleasure, Alex. Thanks for having me.
When the sun was in the sky and love was burning in your eyes, nothing in the world could bother me, 'cause I was living in a world of ecstasy. But now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer. I'm walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own. Now the summer's over and I find myself alone with only memories of you. I was so in love I couldn't see, 'cause I was living in a world of make-believe. Now you're gone, I'm just a daydreamer. I'm walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again. Life is much too beautiful to live it all alone. Oh, how much I need someone to call my very own. I'm just a daydreamer, I'm walking in the rain, chasing after rainbows I may never find again.
Okay, we've just been listening to some of the thoughts of our ace neuropsychologist, of course, and his views on how daydreaming is actually important and critical in terms of life. But what about the whole notion of that feeling, that sense of happiness, the importance of ensuring that you can still actually keep on going? Maybe we actually need to go beyond the whole notion of arguing for, as Jack Lewis would say, the importance of daydreaming, to actually make some conscious decisions in terms of that. So we're delighted to actually welcome the official happiness czar to the program today to share with a whole range of things the joy czar in many ways. Saj Shah, how are you, Saj?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you so much, Alex, for inviting me here. And it's just a pleasure to be here with you all.
Well, it's great to connect with you. Good. So, of course, the team are duly assembled. And I know they've got stacks of questions with respect to this. But let's just start off with this whole notion of life could be too short to hold a grudge. And in fact, I've just watched your TED talk, your TEDx talk, the three stages that you actually went through in terms of obviously coming to grips with the loss of your father, and then realizing how that obviously led you to this whole journey to really enjoy life.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thank you for watching the TED Talk. And it was incredible. The TED Talk, if I can just share, like, it was released at a time when the world was in turmoil or about to embark on it. It was the sort of Russian-Ukraine situation was just about starting. And I had a bit of a hesitation, like, is this the right time to talk about joy and release something like this? I mean, TEDx as the platform released it, but it communicating about it. And what I realized was it's exactly the right time to talk about joy, because that was what was kind of missing. And the success of the talk, in a sense, wasn't just the numbers, but the feedback that I got from people to say, actually, it just the simple message of listening, laughing and loving, and just resonated with a whole load of people who in corporate work that didn't exist. And it didn't exist for me until the point of realization or the awakening of when I lost my father. And so resentment and holding grudges, there's a, you know, we talk about sort of holding grudges and holding resentments. Like in my corporate career, at the highs of it, outwardly, it looked like success. But inwardly, there was a whole load of holding grudges and resentments and you know, wrong making. And it was only after listening to the people at my father's funeral sharing about what my father's legacy was, which was actually inspiring joy in people, you know, leaving people in a better place at the than they were at the start of the conversation with my dad. I mean, that was an incredible philosophy to live life from. Now, my growing up was filled with like joy and laughter. In my corporate life, it sort of flipped into this sort of, you know, seriousness. I've got to be serious to be taken seriously, and I've got to be serious to be a professional. And I was, you know, in a corporate environment as a lawyer as well. I mean, that in itself brings a whole load of seriousness to it. No, you can't be playful. You can't be laughing as a lawyer. We're dealing with serious things. And that was part of the challenge. And the realization for me was I'm a father, and at the time when the height of my sort of corporate career, my eldest was 6 years old, and when they were young, it was just full of playfulness. It was creativity, and it was kind of born from where you know, my own upbringing, you know, playing games and bringing boxes out and creating these sort of molded cars and things like that. But in my corporate life, the seriousness that I was bringing to corporate life started spilling over into home life. And it was all about, no, you've got to do some serious homework. You've got to sit down and laughter and playfulness. I stopped it in a way. And that was kind of the turning point.
I mean, this whole notion of how, certainly in the Western world, we actually can continue to work and continue to work till we drop, can actually have chronic stress. Again, that's a condition that's been dubbed the silent killer. You know, clearly there are messages here that we need to unpick. And I'll introduce the team in a few seconds. But the fact that the TED talk that you gave, Three Keys to Unlock Your Dash of Joy, last year was among the top five most watched lectures on YouTube, I think says that there is a need for this. There's a need in which we actually are looking for happiness, whether that be spiritual. Maybe it's a case of we are spiritual beings on a human journey. Let's turn straight away to our Dutch correspondent, Fia van den Bogert, because it's been quite a time since she's been back with the program. Fia, you're in Balk in the Netherlands. You've been listening to Saj. You always seem to be fairly chills to me as a Dutch soul. Any questions from yourself?
Always very chill. Hi. I was actually wondering, you were talking about your father's legacy, and I was wondering, what would you want your legacy to be, or what do you think your legacy is?
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the practices, and thank you for just bringing that to mind, because my dad didn't actively seek to sort of create a legacy. It just became who he was in life that kind of gave him inspiration, gave him purpose. And I went through kind of a process in my own discovery after losing my own father of like, what would I want my children to say about me in their eulogy? And what sort of transpired was, wow, if I could make a little dent on one of the biggest sort of disabilities of in the world, which is anxiety, depression, and stress, and if I could be a cause in creating a shift in that, and a shift in kind of the language from not toxic positivity, but it's almost sort of moving from kind of a negative sort of survival mindset to actually thriving as communities, being there, having each other's backs, and if I can start changing the conversation with other sort of change makers, then that's a legacy I'm proud of. And it's really the possibility of inspiring joy as a daily reality rather than stress as a daily reality.
I love the notion of toxic positivity. I mean, if ever you could actually describe "Let's do happy," you could actually maybe use that as, yes, as a possible line. Let's move down to France then, Victoria. Your thoughts on this whole site? I mean, obviously we will be featuring "Let's do happy" at the end of this particular piece. But any questions that you've got for Sarge?
Hi, Victoria.
And you will need to unmute yourself. That's all. I need to. Otherwise, we could just lip read.
It's the same as the other day. Hi. Do you find that different audiences in maybe different places have a different reaction to what you're saying to them? If they're, say, from France, we have a completely different culture and relaxed. Maybe in Netherlands, yeah, it's the same, yeah, and other places might be more stressed. Have you got a sense of different cultures and
absolutely, and you know what? It's great that you raised this, because one of the things that I'm also working on is kind of what is joy in different countries and what is joy in different cultures, and there's an element of stress or chronic stress that is prevalent regardless of where you are. The circumstances are kind of different. So, Victoria, I returned 2 weeks ago from the south of France, and we go to France every year, pretty much, and certainly in the Nordics as well. So my brother lives in Norway, and I used to work in Sweden a lot, and Denmark, and you know, so there is definitely a different energy as someone. Being brought up in the UK and working in the kind of UK environment, going into an environment where community is quite strong, where the sense of work hard and play hard is also there, I think is kind of critical to sort of bring back to societies where maybe the you know. We will be happy once we've done our hard slog, and I certainly sort of felt that in the UK, and I know I've worked in the US as well, and that's certainly the frame of reference of like, yeah, look, you can do all of those fun things later, you got to work hard right now, and then what? So I don't know if that answers your question, Victoria, but it definitely. There's definitely things we can learn from different cultures.
Let's turn to Anna Lewis in London. I mean, Anna, obviously you're a mum as well. So you've got children, you had to see that. You've experienced your own parents from that point of view. You've got the Italian background. You've got the Jersey background, all sorts of other areas. You know, listening to what Sarge has been saying, I mean, fundamentally, there seem to be a number of key areas here that seem to be blindingly obvious and almost go back to the whole notion of, well, yes, actually treat other people as you'd like to be treat yourselves from the biblical side of things there. But your thoughts, please, Anna.
Yeah, I mean, it just sprung to mind my son, who's now 26, when he was 18, had a friend who apparently was very happy, in inverted commas, had a girlfriend, was renting a flat, was very independent, they had a pet dog. The trappings looked very happy and he was always smiling, yeah, until he got into drugs. And when that happened, things went downhill very quickly, to the point where, to cut a very long story short, he took an overdose of ecstasy tablets and died. It was in the national media. The morning of his death, I met up with some of his friends at his flat, because obviously my son was very distressed. And they said to me, these teenage boys, he was so happy. Why would he do this? And my answer to that was simple. Happy people don't need to do drugs. And they didn't get it. And I thought, if he's so happy, why is he going out of his way to take substances to make him even happier? Happiness is itself enough. And I think that's the trouble. We expect so much. We expect so much to be right, and we're human beings at the end of the day. Things won't always be right, but we've got to look at the good in what we've done. As you, indeed, you've seen yourself, your father's legacy is universal as much as this. we're not our beliefs. We are what we do. So your father has left the legacy of what he's done and what difference he's made in people's lives, not what he believed, whether he believed in God or Allah mm-hmm. or whoever. The yeah. point is this: he believed in himself in the confident way that's made a difference and left a lasting
it's so beautiful what you've just said, Anna, and thank you for sharing what you did share, and I 100% agree with you. And this is where, Alex, I sort of talk about the toxic positivity. It's almost like we've got to have we've just got to have this sort of yellow face with a smile on our face all the time. And if it's not that, actually, that's not what joy is. See, joy is one of those kind of, it's not happiness. Happiness is kind of the sort of, you know, externally referenced ways of sort of, and it's those fleeting moments. Well, the joy that Anna you sort of alluded to and I'm kind of talking about is that kind of sense of yourself that you can actually contribute to others and make a difference out there, and there's a trust and a confidence in yourself. And joy, I mean, who would have thought that joy could have been triggered at my father's funeral? And it was. So joy can kind of be beside sadness and still make a difference. And I think that's the beauty of discovering joy. But for me, Anna, like what you shared, now I haven't dabbled in any of those sort of substances before. However, if you were to look at my life in my sort of what I would call corporate success, you would have seen a smiley face and a happy-go-lucky person, and people would basically share, "Oh, he's got no worries in the world." You know, one of the biggest realizations was holding on and not sharing what's actually going on, and that was the biggest sort of trigger of joy, is being able to sort of be honest with where you are. And being able to share. And that takes something. I wore a lot of masks for different situations, but behind the mask was this sort of, six-year-old or a 13-year-old that had a sense of himself of not being good enough, and scared of failure, basically. When that sort of mask goes off, and there's kind of an authenticity and a connection with another human being, the realization is actually people are going through similar things, different circumstances.
Mm. And another definition of happiness, of course, is when you complete your dissertation successfully, which I'm sure Tosin will be doing in the fullest of time, really, and indeed working with Afrobeats as well. Tosin, welcome to the Madrid Drive. If you're listening, obviously, to what Saj has been saying, it's almost been a kind of opening therapy session, I feel, which is all good. But Tosin, any questions or thoughts from yourself? I mean, given that, obviously, again, as you've demonstrated, Nigeria is always a happy place.
Yeah, Nigeria is always a happy place, but it's also, like, I think a lot of people put a lot of masks on because, again, Nigeria, there are a lot of things going on in Nigeria, even right now and before I left. And a lot of people just try and smile through the pain or just smile through whatever is going on there. And just make it true. But it's not easy to always smile through it. And I think Nigerians understand that. But we just sometimes take a step back and look at things and be grateful for what we can do and move on. I think that's what I like about Nigerians. We're tolerant in the sense that we understand it's not going to be rosy every time. And we try our best to do what we can and leave the rest up to God or whatever religion we support or whatever you believe in, basically. And for a question, do you think it's human instinct to like to always put on a face, to always have that mask of trying to be perfect and trying to be happy and trying to show that lifestyle of always nothing is happening to me, I'm good, I'm fine and everything? Or is something we build up due to like maybe social media now or things around us? Or do you think it's something that has always been in it to try and be perfect or try and show that we're perfect?
I mean, it's a really, really great question. And by the way, is it pronounced Soyemi?
Shuyemi.
Great. So look, I was brought up in East Africa, and there is a cultural conversation also in Kenya around success and what success looks like. So there is a sense, and it was nothing that was kind of drummed in, but it was almost sort of growing up. It was like to get out to to be somebody, to break through from our heritage or you know, our poverty or whatever, you've got to be here, you've got to make this much money, you've got to be a professional, you've got to own your own business.
There That's were all a doctor, sort of lawyer.
Expectations. Exactly. And I mean, look, I'm an East African Asian in the UK, and I probably ticked all of my sort of, you know, make my Indian parents proud. I became a lawyer. I was a pharmacist. I became a lawyer, and now developing technology. So I kind of ticked those sort of looking good sun pieces.
And now you're on the midweek drive. It doesn't get any better, does it? Really?
You know, it's the circle of life. I mean, this is I'm made up. I mean, it's like, Jamie, it's an interesting question that you kind of raise. Like, are we born with it, or is it something that I'm of the belief that there is a certain amount of like rapid evolution of technology that's happened in a very short space of time that we're not necessarily like our psychology is not necessarily used to it, whereas most of our existence as human beings has been surviving. And so suddenly, like, the technology is taking off and we're sort of catching up in that. And I think we will catch up. That's the ingenuity of human beings. But I think there is a kind of a disconnect there. And some of our, certainly I'm using myself as an example, some of those sort of moments growing up, like, you know, evolving, but actually the language that I would be using when I was a child would be like, well, this person doesn't like me. And then it creates a way of operating in life. Or this person has this against me, and that means that I'm not liked. And then there's a way of operating. So I think the experiences that we actually have create either a constraint or it almost moves you forward, and it's those sort of self-limiting beliefs that I think are sort of created as a result of experiences, and they're all kind of self-created in a way. But you can forgive a six-year-old, but when a six-year-old is operating on a six-year-old strategy as a 48-year-old, there might be a bit it might not work out well.
Yeah.
Shall we frequently obviously cover thoughts with Mike Dooley over in Florida? He's a life coach and so on. But yeah. I particularly like your acronym for STORM, how you actually deal with stress, tiredness, overwhelmingness, resignation and misery, and replacing that with joy. But would you like to just share with us this notion of why, if you simply actually put a bit of joy into the workplace, Britain could well be the envy of the world? And also a bit more about Momentus, please.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So look, I mean, STORM for me, it sort of came about when I was writing the book. Every sort of survey or well-being survey that I went to, both in the US, in the UK and other countries, was pointing to these sort of these five things. It was, you know, stress and anxiety. It was the sense of exhaustion and tiredness being felt, overwhelm was being felt with all of the changes. And this wasn't just post-COVID. This was sort of happening even before we went into lockdown and COVID actually hit. It's sort of, COVID kind of gave us a sort of jumping off the rat, you know, the hamster wheel, and kind of getting connected to what matters. But very soon after, we're back on that hamster wheel. It kind of sums up what's out there as a daily experience for many, particularly many in the workforce today. And each component of the STORM has been scientifically linked to, I've sort of linked it to sort of the science that it actually changes our brain structure and function, and ultimately leads to chronic stress that then leads to various diseases. So my vision is to kind of replace this by, first of all, acknowledging where there is no joy. So the first bit is actually realizing in the areas of life, like, where is there no joy? And that kind of noticing it and acknowledgement of it is the first opening of now doing something about it and having a breakthrough in it. And that for me was the turning point. Actually, like after my father's passing, it was actually looking at like where am I experiencing the storm, and why am I experiencing the storm? What if that is my own creation? What if that is my story about it? And then looking to make a difference in that, and actually bringing a little bit of fun and creativity and playfulness to that discovery.
Well, that certainly ties in with Jack Lewis's thoughts on the whole notion of daydreaming and the importance of actually daydreaming. Fia, you're approaching the new season of Korfball. Obviously, there are all sorts of other bits and pieces doing within that. I mean, how do you relate to what you've been hearing from Saj about the importance of getting the balance right, the joy, the importance of that as a philosophy?
Oh, well, related to Korfball, you mean? Or
your own life?
I think I've definitely struggled with what you said about joy and the storm. Mm-hmm. And I actually had a half year where I was so stressed and I couldn't really do anything. And I just really had to find myself, I guess, and really reflect on what am I doing? What is the goal? Because I was such a perfectionist and so focused on always getting the best grades and always doing better than everybody else. And I just discovered that it wasn't working anymore, I guess. And I've
written my life story.
Yeah. So, and I still struggle with how I treat my colleagues, and that I always, I am always very focused on, okay, you have to do it like this and this and this. And I just letting go of that is still something I really, I still struggle with. And I'm always struggling also, like, how do I not hold a grudge against those colleagues? Because I just have to let it go.
Yes. I mean, it's you just raise a really, really interesting piece, because and it totally resonates. So I was kind of the master of holding resentments and regrets. Like, you know, that's the resentment over here with me, for even having the resentment for somebody else, because that isn't really who I am. But it was kind of toying with the corporate world, and you've got to be a certain somebody. And you know, even as a lawyer, you know, there was a boss of mine at one stage basically said, "You're too nice to be a lawyer." You know, I mean, that stuck in me. I have to be nasty to make it as a lawyer, you know. Those sort of things was kind of the norm, and that was the kind of conversation. And it's normally sort of associated with Buddha, and I don't know what the origins of it. There's a famous sort of saying, and that saying really powerfully conveys the idea of, like, when you're harboring resentment or anger, it actually harms the person who's holding on to it, rather than the person it's directed to. And the saying goes something like, holding on to anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. Now, look, there is absolutely is injustice and wrongdoing in everyday life. And it's natural to get upset or when something unfair happens, and there's, you know, that's the human tendency, because it's kind of, you know, I've done something wrong, or it's not the way I need it to be, or there's an expectation there that's not been met. But there's like a growing body of research, and this is where my real sort of excitement comes. There's a body of research that's actually showing us how holding on to those resentments changes our biology. There might be a past-based sort of memory which was right because of the wrongdoing at that time. And it's not about sweeping the wrongdoing under the carpet and saying it's okay. But at that time, it created a stress in the body, which was a survival instinct, and it's a good thing. However, reliving the grudge keeps the biology as it was back then. And it keeps, you know, the body does not know the difference. And you're creating the same sort of stress hormones on a loop, so to speak, every time you think about it, every time you think about someone that you've had a grudge on. And that's what then ultimately leads, that those acute moments of stress then actually pile up to then become chronic stress. And chronic stress is now, known as the source of pretty much 90% of most of the modern day diseases. So there's kind of a connection there. The opposite of that is forgiveness. And it's also the most difficult thing to practice.
Victoria, as a musician, singer-songwriter, it often says that you have such an important role to kind of facilitate people's challenges in life, etc., and reflecting on that. Any thoughts from yourself?
Well, actually, music is my therapy. I'm glad that people can, and the whole point is so that people can also use my therapy for them as well. But I'm almost the opposite of fear, because I ended up being in a situation where I kept going lower and lower and lower, and it was nothing to do. It wasn't anything I could control. But then I resented people that were my friends, because maybe they were in a different life situation that I felt that I should be in, but because I wasn't well enough to do that, I would keep sinking, and then I got even more sick, or I would, and it would just be on a rotation. But the more music I do, there's the joy that you have. And I think it was only at Christmas that I started going, okay, I'm going to forgive and forget, not resent the people that are doing really well, because you have to be happy for them that they are getting all these things. And actually, it was only a few weeks ago, I put a post up on Facebook, and I was actually looking back, because I kept saying to myself, I'm still nowhere, I'm not doing anything. And I went back and wrote, okay, 2 years ago, I was here. 18 months ago, I was here. A year ago, I was here. And now look what I've achieved in that time. And that in itself is joy, just looking back and seeing what you've achieved.
Amazing, Victoria. And thank you for sharing that, because what you've just demonstrated in what you've just shared is the practice of forgiveness. Because I firmly believe, like, what you just shared is so powerful. Because you, first of all, you noticed that this isn't working for me, like being in this spiral. And you said, all right, you interrupted it. You interrupted it, and you kind of got back to begin with yourself. Like, you brought compassion to yourself. That's the beginnings of forgiveness, right? You started with yourself. Like, before you can genuinely forgive others, you kind of need to forgive yourself and the regrets that you're holding on to, past mistakes, unmet expectations, not being perfect, and all of those sort of things. And then you started with yourself, and what you brought in by doing your sort of, like, where you are now, having done some of those things, you brought gratitude in. And that is one of the most simplest but powerfulest actions that you can take. It's when you focus on kind of your life's blessings and what you've kind of achieved in the time that you've been ruminating about it's not going well, and you get present to that, there is no room for bitterness, either to yourself or others.
No, because it was making me even, the more I got het up on it, it would make me even worse. So I have found that getting better, I mean, it wasn't anything to do with being a depressed or anything, or like that, but getting better, it's actually helped getting better in other ways as well. So you kind of, I do understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And now you say that I've done a good thing, that I can put that on my list too.
you reclaimed your own peace and joy and power back, right? Because it was always there. Didn't go anywhere.
You made me cry now.
Yeah, key points. Absolutely. No, we were very, very much so on that basis. Okay, we're beginning to come to the end of what I think has been a very powerful sequence of various other bits and pieces. Tosin, we'll go back to your good self. Any other thoughts that you'd like to raise at present? Preferably unmuted.
Sorry, I'm back now. I just want to say, like, what Victoria was talking about and Stad was talking about comparing yourself to other people. There's this quote, and I try to use it to, like, make sure I don't copy myself to people. Comparison is the thief of joy, in the sense that, like, it takes away, once you compare people, yourself to people that are doing better than you, you take away all the good things you are doing, and, like, you push it to one side, and you're focused on their own good things, and then it just makes you go down and down and down and down, and get all these negative thoughts, and you're keeping yourself, and you said your biology will change, and from there, it's a downward spiral, downward spiral, downward spiral. So, like I said, like Saj said, just being grateful about what you've done already and where you're trying to go to and what you've achieved, is it's a great way of pushing that comparison away and just being with yourself and knowing that you're still on a journey and you're still trying to find yourself, trying to go where you want to go, basically. And it's a great helper in mental health and where you want to be, basically.
Yeah. So, Saj, how can people actually follow your good self? Do they simply type in your name, as indeed I did, into YouTube, pull up the TED Talks, TEDx Talks, etc.? What's the way of actually following through on what we've been spending a little bit of time on today?
No, brilliant. Well, look, I'm on LinkedIn, so come find me on LinkedIn, Saj Shah. Definitely, as you found me, Alex, if you go into YouTube and type Saj Shah in, my TED Talk will, I think, be the sort of first one that sort of shows up. I have a website. It's joynetics.com, joynetix.com. That's really about the book and why I wrote it, and then sort of links to all of the usual sort of book retailers that have my book, Amazon being one of them. And then you can just go onto Amazon and find my book there as well.
And that's brought us around to two of those classic interrogatives. And the first one I'm going to ask to deliver them is fear. Would you like to ask Shah the first question, please?
Yes, definitely. Have you had a reasonably good sumo with us today?
Very good. Very good. I mean, like, just repeat your question again. It's like,
have you had a reasonably good sumo with us? That's all based on it.
Absolutely.
Sort of Zoom room.
No, I sensed it was Zuma, but yeah, no, brilliant. It's been, well, first of all, what I want to say is the energy and the openness that you've brought and the sharing, because it's just been very authentic and real. And that in itself is it triggers joy for me. So thank you.
Saj, we only have the very best on the Madrid driver, so in a sequence of things, part and parcel, of course. So Victoria, what's the second question?
Will you join us again?
Yes, is the answer.
Excellent.
Very simple. There we are.
Anna Lewis, has it been good for you?
It has. It's been really eye-opening. Thank you, Saj. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
And Fia, I know we might be switching your time slots onto those of the program, but has it been good for your good self?
It's been very good, thank you.
Excellent. Tosin, of course, will be back in the studio next week. So that's a whole new sort of experience from that point of view. So that's all great. And likewise, Victoria, we'll see you doubtless for Resonance Rewind in the very near future. We won't. Oh, well, never mind. We'll see you next week for the Madrid Drive.
Yes.
Excellent. To Victoria Simmons, Fia van den Bogert, Tosin Shoyemi, Anna Lewis, of course, and Saj Shah, huge thanks. And keep on being happy.
Thank you. Thank you all.